after she asked that a group of brain-damaged audience members who were seated near the stage in wheelchairs be moved to the rear. Shapiro is the executive director of the Pennsylvania Coalition of Citizens with Disabilities. It's a coalition of 25 groups representing 70,000 Pennsylvanians. We invited her to Fresh Air to discuss how she became an activist in the disabled rights movement and to discuss some of the current issues she's organizing around. Sigi Shapiro, welcome to Fresh Air.
It's good to be here, Tari.
How did you first become an activist?
Well, about 10 years ago, 1973, I happened to see a cover story on the Sunday Inquirer magazine about an old friend of mine, Mimi Nelkin, who had gone to Widener Memorial School with me. And I thought, that's where she is. I found her again because she had moved a couple of times since I last saw her. I called her, and she said that she was trying to put together an organization in Pennsylvania called Disabled in Action of Pennsylvania. She'd been active in the DIA organization in New York before that. And I said, well, would you like some help? And she said, absolutely. And that's how I became involved, really organizing a group rather than moving into that. We just started a group right away.
Did that organizing affect your own self-image?
It affected me in many different ways. I've had a chronic pain problem for the past 20 years or so, and it was affecting my ability to work full-time. It was affecting my ability to participate in a lot of different activities. The fact that I'm orthopedically handicapped really wasn't the difficulty. The problem was indeed the pain, and it had caused me to have all kinds of doubts about myself, and since doctors couldn't find the source of pain, you know what goes on in one's mind when that happens. And being able to get involved in something meaningful and working hours, which were hours that were flexible, really helped me a great deal. And it certainly changed my self-image and I think really changed my life.
How long have you been disabled?
Since I was, well, rather than say that, I'll say about 35 years. I was in the hospital, and I had had pneumonia after some surgery. And while I was in the hospital, I was given some injections, and an overdose of these injections caused paralysis in my right leg. Subsequent to that, I've learned that I also have a real problem with my hips, and I've got very bad arthritis. And that's why I'm using a wheelchair now.
Mm-hmm. When you were in elementary school and then junior high and high school, were you in a separate class for people in wheelchairs?
I wasn't so fortunate because actually, while I don't endorse separate classes in so-called normal schools, it certainly would have been a step above what I went through, which was going to the Widener Memorial School for Crippled Children. The word crippled being a real no-no among us now has such negative connotations. And I had hoped to leave there at a certain point and go to my regular normal school, as people call it, or neighborhood school, and was not able to do that. I think it was good for me in the sense that I received therapy there when I was very, very young, as a matter of fact, at the age of 3 1/2, and they did indeed get me back on my feet again. But after I was rehabilitated and I had learned how to cope, I think that I should have been moved out into a regular setting, and I wasn't. Some people fought that and indeed were able to get into other schools. My family chose not to, and I don't, you know, blame them for that. But I'm very happy that I've been part of a movement that's brought about the mainstreaming of disabled kids into the school systems.
Have you compared notes with people your age who were in a more mainstream situation who were also in wheelchairs? Because I remember in the school I went to, there were like two separate classes in which everybody who was in a wheelchair or was hearing impaired were grouped together. And there wasn't a whole lot of interaction between the students in those classes and the students in the rest of the school.
Well, it's interesting. As I've traveled about working on disability rights issues around the country, I've met people, and a lot of the people in the movement, disabled people themselves, think that they can peg or they can identify the person who's gone to a disabled school. Okay, a school for handicapped kids, as opposed to those kids who have been mainstreamed. And everyone was amazed to find out that I went to a special school because I don't have that kind of personality.
What's the personality?
The personality is definitely, by and large, someone who is not as outgoing, is not as willing to try and attempt new things, not as free and open, not as self-confident, hasn't had the experiences, and in many cases, the quality education, even though there's a big debate about how good the quality is of education in the school system here, there certainly was a difference between what you got in a so-called special school and what you got in a so-called regular school. And I found that out when I went on to college.
So you support mainstreaming now?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's some cases where there is a need for special schools for kids who could not possibly be mainstreamed because of the difficulties they have or the special things that they might need. I think there's still a place for special schools, but I think it's a much smaller place now than it used to be.
I know that for parents of deaf children, there's a couple of deaf schools for the deaf that are in jeopardy and might be closed down, and the parents are very upset because they think that the quality of education will suffer for their children if they're put into a mainstream situation.
As a matter of fact, that group that's active in this area called Action Alliance of Parents of the Deaf is a member of our coalition, and I've spoken with their delegate, Dr. Jane King, who has a deaf son and is concerned about this issue. What they're concerned about is that the deaf students, while being mainstreamed, will not receive the quality care or attention or teaching that is required. And in this particular case, I think that it should be left up to the family and, if possible, the student. I think that Pennsylvania School for the Deaf must remain, and I think we're going to do everything we can to try and see that that happens because there's a need for that kind of school.
Did you have any role models when you were growing up of people who were disabled who had succeeded in their chosen profession?
Not very many. It was quite late in life before I realized that Franklin Roosevelt was indeed a disabled person and used a wheelchair, and really began to understand why it was hidden while he was in office. There was Ray Charles, you know, that people always think of the blind singers as the first role model. There really weren't many when I was growing up, people who were disabled. I remember watching the Mickey Mouse Club and wanting to be a stewardess when they had a series where the young girl, you know, went to flight school for flight attendants, and the boy went through pilot training. And I told my mother I wanted to be a stewardess, and she tried her best to explain to me that she didn't think I could. There's now a woman who's a stewardess with an artificial leg. So we're very happy to see that.
Did you feel that there were career opportunities open to you? Did you get counseling or anything that helped you?
I think the folks at Widener, when I was going, were good in that they they finally did listen to me when I said I wanted to go to college, and they compromised and let me take the business and academic courses. They helped me get a scholarship to Temple University, and I wanted to go into teaching, but when I went down to the Philadelphia Board of Ed to ask about the requirements, they said they would not hire me because I was disabled, and they wanted to know what I would do in case of a fire, you know, to get the students out of the building. At that time, I was walking on crutches, by the way. I just started using the wheelchair in the last 10 years or so. And they found all different kinds of reasons why they wouldn't hire a disabled teacher unless it were to teach at Widener School. And I felt it would be a long time before there would be an opening in one school in Philadelphia. So I changed my career ideas. I ended up working in personnel management.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Siggy Shapiro, and she's the executive director of the Pennsylvania Coalition of Citizens with Disabilities. What was the first really successful action that you participated in?
Well, I think one of the first successful actions was when a gentleman who was an amputee came to us and said that he had been discriminated against by an insurance company who had carried his insurance policy for his automobile prior to his becoming an amputee but refused to carry him after he lost his leg. And we had a demonstration. That was one of our first demonstrations outside the insurance company's building in Center City, and we were able to resolve that situation for him. After that, you may have heard of the trans bus and the effort to get a low-floor, wide-door, ramped bus on city streets. While we didn't get that particular bus, which we still feel was the best-designed bus for everyone's needs, not just the disabled, we were able to get accessible transportation of one form or another in the cities around the country.
What do you think have proven to be the most effective ways of making handicapped people a political force?
Well, right now, speaking very honestly, we're becoming very politically minded and working on voter registration and working with certain people who have indicated an interest to run for elective office. We're learning from previous civil rights movements that this is the way to really wield some clout and some power. And so we've had various voter registration drives. I was at a meeting at the Democratic National Committee headquarters about a month ago to talk to them about getting people involved in the political process as delegates to the National Convention and becoming involved in precinct meetings and ward meetings. And that, of course, involves making those meetings accessible in terms of holding them in accessible buildings and helping with transportation. We're going to be doing the same with Republicans and with other parties because we feel this is the way to go now.
Do you think that the numbers are large enough to be a powerful force in candidates and elections?
Absolutely, if we can get the disabled together. And that's an interesting problem because while women are all women and they have that in common and blacks have their color in common and homosexuals and you know, gays have that in common, with a disabled movement, we are men, women, children, we're black, white, every minority. We come from every economic strata, and there's not just one disability that we all have in common. There's mental retardation, deafness, blindness, orthopedic disabilities, and everything in between. And it's difficult sometimes to get those groups together. That's why we're very excited about what's happening with the Pennsylvania Coalition of Citizens with Disabilities. It's really a first.
Do you know what you would do if there was a candidate who endorsed your platform for disability rights, but who was opposed to other issues that you felt strong on, perhaps women's issues or other issues that you thought were really important that they opposed?
I personally, if you're asking me on a personal level, would have to look at that candidate's entire record.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a problem that all of us are facing. We've become involved in one issue, and I think it's very wrong to vote for a candidate based on just that one issue. You've got to look at the entire platform of that candidate and hopefully vote for the one who supports your ideas as well.
You were the co-organizer of the protest in front of the City Line Dinner Theater a few weeks ago after the Zsa Zsa Gabor incident. Looking back on the waves that were caused by that incident, what did it tell you about the consciousness of Philadelphians and of the press?
Well, I have to admit that even this length of time after that happening on the 2nd of June, we're still kind of amazed at what took place. First of all, we were amazed that Zsa Zsa was as really stupid as she was to do something like that. We were also amazed by the management backing our position totally and firing Ms. Gabor. As I understand, it was after a series of other incidents, and this was the capper, and they just wouldn't stand for it any longer. But the thing that really amazed us was that the demonstration that took place really wasn't all that organized. We made key phone calls and contacted key groups, but the support we got from the general public was absolutely astounding. And when I did a radio interview earlier in the afternoon before the demonstration and mentioned the time, a lot of people came out who were not disabled, who were able-bodied people or people who worked with disabled people who just supported what we were saying, which was, you cannot discriminate against disabled people in this fashion. And we were very encouraged by that. And indeed, we've gotten calls from the story spread all over the country and indeed was covered by the European press as well. So we've gotten calls from all over saying, congratulations for what you did. Thanks for standing up for my rights in the case of a California housewife who's disabled and another one in Cincinnati. They were glad there was a group there who stood up for what was right where disabled people were concerned. We couldn't get over the press coverage. I think the best thing that came out of this was that there's a renewed interest and indeed sometimes an initial new interest by the press and others in disability rights issues. There have been a lot of follow-up stories on general disability rights issues, and that's what's really pleased us.
How do you think Zsa Zsa Gabor's reputation came into play in the reaction to the story, since she is known as a very temperamental, self-centered person? And a lot of people, I think, dislike her already because of that. because of the persona that, that she's had on all the talk shows that she's been on for so many years.
Yes. I certainly think that she was probably an easier target than someone else might be. Some distinguished actor, you know, Sir Laurence Olivier or someone, if they did the same thing, I don't know that that person would have been fired, okay, for whatever reason. And I think the situation would have become a little more difficult. We still would have stood up for the principal, but it would have been a different kind of situation. She's been cited as possibly being an easier target in some of the news coverage, and I think that was probably right. But we were disregarding that and saying, look, no matter who it was the issue that was important. And disabled people who pay their money to go somewhere cannot be moved just because they're disabled.
Sigi Shapiro is my guest, if you're just joining us. She co-organized the protest against Gabor that we were just discussing, and she's the executive director of the Pennsylvania Coalition of Citizens with Disabilities. I wonder what you think of the telethons that happen annually, and there's several of them, that go for research into various disabilities, and usually there are children with disabilities who are shown to the audiences and used to help generate sympathy and money.
Not a lot, in a nutshell. They distress me terribly. I remember as a child going to a special camp for handicapped kids run by one of the major agencies serving disabled people and being trotted about to sing in front of different groups. Indeed, that happened at Widener as well. And I remember the photographers who would cover this story telling me to roll up the leg of my slacks so that my brace would show better and these kinds of things. And I know friends who have been asked to appear on telethons as young children and sing Climb Every Mountain, you know, while they're in a wheelchair. And simply outrageous stuff that's been done where a lot of my colleagues are concerned. And our main objection to these telethons is not that people are trying to do good and trying to solve a problem. We support trying to do that. But the way disabled people are used and the way their image is distorted so that when I go out shopping, for example, which happened to me just about 6 months ago at a major department store, a little old lady will come up to me and pat me on the head and say, oh, dear, how did you get here? Are you here all by yourself? And it's like, you know, my word, it's a major miracle that this person is able to function. And I think telethons continue that kind of idea in people's minds that we're helpless, we're victims, we're ill. And the only way for our salvation is for people to be good and to give. And there have been some changes. I certainly think that after the major flap over the muscular dystrophy telethon, which indeed was sponsored by the Disability Rights Center in Washington and ACCD, which is the American Coalition of Citizens with Disabilities, our counterpart on the national level, it changed some attitudes. Jerry was very hurt. You know, Jerry Lewis was very hurt, and he complained very, very loudly. But by what happened was that changes were made.
What kind of changes?
More disabled adults were shown who are successful, who have made it in society. The way that they, you know, they always want the little blonde girl with pigtails, you know. The way they showed children in the little film segments was different in that they showed them going about their daily life activities and not necessarily in a doctor's office, this poor little kid, what's going to happen to him or her next, you know. And it was much more positive in tone and visually, which was very important. And those changes are also happening in other similar kinds of agencies.
A lot of the celebrities come on and say, thank God I have two kids. They're both healthy. How do you feel when you hear that?
I cringe. You saw me now when you said that. It's like, you know, my mother is supposed to curse God because she had me. You know, it's absolutely outrageous. Certainly you can be thankful that you have healthy children, that your family is healthy. I'm thankful that my family is healthy. But not thank God that we weren't cursed by this awful disability for our child. You know, not that kind of attitude. Because it only makes it harder in the long run for that child to be properly educated, to grow up, to get a job in society, to move about. The things we're asking for, we feel, are equal access and equal opportunities. And I think because of the attitude that's created by these telethons and similar efforts, people view these things as special accommodations. And that's what we're trying to change. We're not asking for special things. We're asking for equal access and opportunities.
Is this controversial amongst disability rights groups, since some of the people who have disabilities are suffering from specific diseases like muscular dystrophy, for which there might be some kind of cure or remedy, and other people are probably suffering from a problem that's less likely to be cured with the money raised for research?
If I could back up for just a second and tell you what really annoys me about the telethons and that system is the fact that that's the system in this country used to raise money to do research and find cures. And they then put disabled people and different groups of disabled people, kind of pit them against one another, because these people in this group might be helped by the research and the cures that are found, and they, of course, support raising money that way to find cures. Other people are saying, as you grow older and as you get out in the world, you're going to realize that this is really putting you down and not helpful. So sure, there are arguments within the disabled community over this, but I think basically just about 95% of them deep down resent these kinds of actions, and that this is the way in this country to raise the money to find the cures and to do the research and to buy the braces. Muscular Dystrophy Association is fantastic. They buy braces, crutches, they provide you with everything you need. I never had that kind of support. I don't resent people having that kind of support. I resent the fact that that's how it's done.
How would you like to see it done?
I would like to see, I don't know how this is going to label me in some people's books, but I would like to see some kind of national health program in this country, similar to the ones my relatives have in Germany, for example, and people and friends of mine in other parts of Europe, whereby it's given that the society wants to have healthy people in the country, and that they will do what it takes in terms of providing wheelchairs or braces or hearing aids or whatever to make sure that that person can get out there and function and live an independent and a good, happy life. And trying to do it any other way, I think, is wrong, and I think it's backwards. And I think that financially, if you want to talk in terms of finances, it's ridiculous, because it ends up costing a lot more in the long run.
Let me change the subject a minute here. What kind of report card would you give the Reagan administration on its policies and their effect on people with disabilities?
A very bad one. When Reagan was running for the presidency, he put together a Handicapped Americans for Reagan campaign committee about 2 months before the election, whereas Carter, and I'm not saying I totally endorse Carter either, but he had Disabled Americans for Carter committees in every state of the union, and indeed made a real effort to work with the disabled community. Reagan's effort was obviously a PR effort very late in the game that really didn't come off. And I think that was a real early indication of what it was going to be like when he was in the White House. And what has happened since he's been in the White House is that every single civil rights law that we worked for and obtained over the past 10 or 15 years has been up for revision, has been rewritten. We've had proposed rules changes on just about every one of them. And it's like we're treading water right now just to stay where we are. We're certainly not moving ahead, and we're fighting like hell to keep from falling backwards.
Do you find that there's more legislation on a statewide or federal basis that affects disabled people?
I would say probably federal, because efforts have been concentrated on the federal level. Back to when Hubert Humphrey worked for the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 and the Education for All Handicapped Children Act in 75, that's where the focus was. Some states have been better than others, though, and there's some good state laws that indeed supplant some of the federal legislation.
What are some of the major issues you're organizing around now?
Well, a major issue here in Pennsylvania, and certainly nationally as well, is attendant care or independent living services. It's been shown time and time again when studies have been done that if the services are provided whereby someone could come in the morning and help the disabled person get up and out of bed and into the wheelchair or whatever, and come again in the evening and help them with dinner and get back into bed, that person can get out and do a job and work and provide for himself for herself. Instead, people are being institutionalized at a phenomenal cost for each individual. And fiscally, it's wrong, and morally, it's absolutely wrong to treat people like this. I was at a meeting of the state Vocational Rehabilitation Board last week, and there was a big debate over the issue of how they were going to find the money to keep people out of institutions, because there have been cutbacks of the federal funding, and there are problems with the state funds right now. And everyone was trying to do everything they could to keep people from ending up back in institutions or having to go there in the first place. It's a very important issue because it gives people a life. And it gives them independence, and they can produce for society, as opposed to keeping them locked up somewhere in those old closets where everyone is hurt.
What are some of the other issues?
Transportation is still a very important issue here in Philadelphia, where we have our daily battles with SEPTA. The Reagan administration changed the federal rules on public transportation so that the transit authorities were no longer mandated to provide equal access to their transit facilities. Now they can do what's called local option. And SEPTA has opted to provide what's called a paratransit system, where you call a day ahead and make a reservation, and someone will come and pick you up and take you where you're going and then bring you back again, which sounds great. You know, anyone would love to have someone come and pick them up and bring them home, but there are a lot of problems. The hours are restricted. You have to know what you're going to do at least a day in advance. Actually, now a day and a half in advance, because they're finding they're getting overloaded and they can't handle it, so you now have to call a day and a half in advance. You have to be ready to leave whatever function you're attending during the week at 9:15 at night. You know, so obviously disabled people don't stay out late. And they're saying they're going to have to start putting a priority on the kinds of trips people take. Whereas before you could just call up and ask to go anywhere. Now, because they're getting overloaded, they're going to have to say, well, we'll take the ones who are going to work or going to the doctor or something first. And then if there are any trips left over that we can make, then you can go food shopping or to the movies or whatever you want to do. We knew this was going to happen. And that's why we knew it was going to be terribly expensive. And that's why we advocated making the existing facilities accessible, because in the long run, it would be less expensive, less labor intensive as well, and that people would have the freedom they were trying to get.
Mm-hmm. Are more buildings being built with access for people in wheelchairs?
Yeah, I think we certainly can look at the bright side on that. Since the federal legislation, and we have state legislation in Pennsylvania and most of the other states, and indeed local ordinances, buildings built after 1968 must be accessible. And indeed, when they're renovated, I believe it's over 50% of the building is renovated in some way, then it has to be made accessible as well. We're seeing more and more curb cuts in the city, and we're doing pretty well as far as public buildings are concerned. When it comes to theaters, we're in the midst of a battle right now with the Forest Theater, because that's not federally funded, and it was built before the deadline. And so we've got a real problem with places like that, and the management there is not being cooperative at all.
There are, in most parking lots, a few spots reserved for people with disabilities. I think consciousness has been raised a lot about actually saving those spots and not parking in them if you're walking. What's your experience been?
It may be a little better, but not a lot. I think that the police are doing a little better job where they have jurisdiction of ticketing people who park in those spaces illegally. One of the problems we're facing now is still that percentage of the population who just does not care. At a supermarket the other night, I was there, and this guy in a Cadillac pulled up and waltzed into the store, you know, and waltzed right out again. Obviously, didn't need to park there. He was just in a hurry. That kind of stuff still goes on. But I think as attitudes improve, you know, that should get better as well. The real problem we're facing on that issue is that there are a lot of people who really don't need those spaces who are somehow qualifying to get handicapped park or handicapped license plates, and they're being given out very freely in Harrisburg, and we're trying to do something to change that. And also disabled veterans. I love disabled veterans. They've helped us on a lot of issues. But anyone who is disabled 5% disabled can get a disabled veteran's license tag. And that person may have a little problem with his hearing or a problem with a hand or something, and he can still park in a handicapped parking space in this state. Whereas in New Jersey, if you have a disabled veteran tag, it doesn't entitle you to park in a handicapped parking space. You've got to get an additional handicapped parking thing.
So there's a lot of competition for those few spots.
There's becoming a great deal of competition. It's amazing how many people are now disabled who weren't before.
Do you ever say anything to someone like that gentleman in the Cadillac who is not disabled at all and who parks in one of the disability spots?
Well, it's interesting. On occasion, I have said something to people who do that. It really depends on the situation. I have a friend, however, who will pull her car in behind that person's car and remain there until that person comes out and really chew them out when they've done that. I'm a little hesitant to do that only because I have a husband who really looks out for my welfare and remembers the incident on the expressway where one car pulled in front of another one and cut him off in traffic, and indeed, the guy stopped his car and shot the other person. I don't know if you remember that a couple of years ago. And he's always saying you never know how a person's going to react. And, you know, you want to be careful how you handle things like that. So I'm careful. But I do have these tickets that, well, they're not tickets. They look like tickets that give the message. And I put those on the cars.
Can you give a phone number for your coalition for anyone who's interested and wants to find out more?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, we have an advocacy project right now, and we can help any disabled people who have been discriminated against due to their disability. So if they want to call PCCD, the number is 842-0596, and we'd be happy to hear from them. We've also gotten a new project to train people about their rights in attendant care and how to get attendant care programs in Pennsylvania. So if they're interested in either one of those things, they can contact us.
Let me repeat that phone number. It's 842-0596. That's 842-0596. That's number for the Pennsylvania Coalition of Citizens with Disabilities. And my guest has been Siggy Shapiro, who is the executive director of that group. And thanks very much for talking with us. It's really been interesting.
Oh, it's been a pleasure to be here, Terry. Thank you.
Thanks. This is Fresh Air. It's 25 minutes to 4 o'clock, and you're tuned to WHYY 91 FM. Coming up later today on the program at about 4 o'clock, we'll be hearing from Lawrence Barrett, who's just written a new book on the Reagan administration. It's called Gambling with History. There's going to be a press conference with President Reagan this evening, and one of the issues that's expected to be brought up is a story that was broken in the Lawrence Barrett book, in which an aide to Reagan swiped a copy of Carter's prep notes for the Carter-Reagan debate and used those notes to prep Reagan. So that's going to be one of the subjects of discussion on the press conference tonight. Well, we'll be hearing from the author of the book in which that story was disclosed this afternoon at 4 o'clock. At 4:30, we'll be hearing from...